This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
It's time to raise your game. I'm Tasha Fusil. Mark Stevenson is an entrepreneur, author, broadcaster, occasional comedian, and expert on global trends and innovation. He's also the founder of the League of Pragmatic Optimists, an organization that creates meeting places in cities and towns across the globe, where people who want to make the world better can meet, generate ideas and projects, and find collaborators to work together in their cause to improve the story of humanity. So we catch up with Mark to find out about the principles of pragmatic optimism that this league lives by. So first, Mark introduces the idea of pragmatic optimism.
So it's a combination of sort of being Martin Luther King and being an engineer. It's about dreaming that the world can be better and believing it can be, because optimism is really a moral position. If you're not prepared to believe the world can be better, then how are we ever going to make it better? So it's a kind of an unashamed ambition of saying, let's imagine that things can be more equitable and just and humane and sustainable. But it's not just wishful thinking. The pragmatism comes in, okay, now let's go and do that. And let's do that by embracing evidence, critical thinking, by getting diverse people together to work together. So rather than have sort of a political or ideologically divided world where people have opinions about what we should do, it's more of an engineering mindset. It's about getting people to come together to work on problems. And you find very quickly that their ideologies quite often disappear when they're both trying to build a bridge or, you know, help the local hospital or whatever it is. So it's about combining an engineering, get your hands dirty mindset with an aspirational Martin Luther King, Eleanor Roosevelt kind of mindset.
This is idea, the notion that this is an engineered mindset. I mean, you're not innately born. You know, we may all want the world to be better, but, you know, human emotion, cynicism, our propensity to be negative is sort of what keeps us in that wishful thinking stage. So to become a pragmatic optimist, you kind of have to, you have to put effort into it.
Yeah, I mean, the pragmatism is embracing all our principles, but one of them is, you know, you are what you do, not what you intend to do. So, and another one of our principles is that, you know, cynicism, you know, is essentially a bad thing. And the reason is that, you know, we're born to be cynical. It's actually part of our neurology. It comes from when we were all on the East African savannah, in the cradle of humanity, and it only took one member of your tribe to go over a hill without checking for lions and get eaten by a lion. And you were pretty cynical about hills from that moment on. So we're automatically programmed to be kind of scared because we're just want to make sure that nothing's going to hurt us. And therefore, this is why the media always leads on the scary stuff. The first thing everybody does when they wake up in the morning is check for lions and fire, even though they don't realize they're doing it. So we have this natural propensity that's actually hardwired into us to be quite fearful and quite scared for very good evolutionary reasons. But you have to get past that, because without optimism that the world can get better, and without getting past that fear, you'll never change anything. And what's happened nowadays is that fear has also morphed into this kind of lazy cynicism where people just say, well, it'll never change. It's too hard. I don't want to do it. And I always like to say that cynicism is really just obedience. It's obedience to the thing that you're complaining about. You know, you complain about it, but you're not really prepared to do anything about it. So really, you've become a lapdog. You're obedient to the thing that you say you hate, which isn't a very satisfying position to be in. And cynics are not very satisfied people. They're generally quite miserable. You know, one of the things that I often say is, think of a great leader. You know, every single one of your listeners now, if I said, think of a great leader, it could be somebody in your work, somebody you know in your personal life, somebody who inspires you, who leads people on, or it could be somebody, you know, brilliant from history. You know, it could be, you know, someone like Martin Luther King. Now ask yourself, was that person a cynic? Was that person a pessimist? And of course, the answer is always no, because as Helen Keller said, you know, a pessimist never discovered anything. So it's essential that we do it otherwise, because all progress actually is dependent on us adopting that kind of mindset.
You know, this ties in, I mean, with the first principle that you talk about, which is having an unashamed optimism of ambition. And this really, you know, resonated, because, you know, when you're in a room full of cynics, you do feel that sort of fear or embarrassment to be an optimist, to openly be in favor of the idea that anything could be better, the world could be better.
Yeah, and there's a lot of social pressure not to do that. And as I say, that's usually driven by people's fear of change, which, as I said, was sort of wired into our brains to a certain extent. Mm. But at the end of the day, I always think it's kind of also like there's a massive personal dividend to being an optimist. know, regardless of the thing, that that's actually the right thing to do for society, be optimistic about our future and try and make that happen. You'll find that optimists generally have a happier disposition, they have better relationships, they, you know, go to nicer parties, have more fun, you know, because people want to be around that. Nobody wants to get stuck next to a cynic on the bus into work because
right.
It just drags you down. But we're all inspired by those great stories, you know, and those great leaders that we think about. Mm. And the people that, you know, I'm just currently reading, you know, Maya Angelou's autobiography again. It's, you know, her ability to be optimistic in the face of racism and prejudice and believe the world could get better and make herself a conduit through which that happened, it means that she's now one of the most iconic and most revered and most loved, you know, women in history. And so, you know, there is this dividend not only for society but also for health. And I think that's worth holding on to. And there's another great quote from, I think it's Howard Aitken, he was a computer engineer. I think it was him, I may be wrong, but the quote is, don't worry about people stealing your ideas. If your ideas are any good, you'll have to ram them down people's throats. And I kind of think that sometimes it's the same with like optimism. You go, look, it really can be better. It is going to be. And look, I'm gonna make it happen. Amelia Earhart once said, never interrupt anybody doing something you said was impossible. And I think, yeah, I'd rather be the Amelia Earhart than the person in the corner sort of, you know, bitching about why things will never change. And I think I'm happier that way.
So for the, you know, for the cynic who wants to reform, the cynic who wants to transition into optimism, I mean, the fact that you said, you know, you said that you were rereading Maya Angelou's autobiography, and that's probably one way to do it, right? You have to constantly kind of fill the tank with inspiration. You can't just let sort
yeah,
of, yeah.
I think so. Filling the tank is a good thing. In fact, the book that I'm just finishing now that will come out next year is sort of 10 or 12 stories of inspirational people who've taken on a very big existing system and created something better and more worthwhile and ethical and sustainable and humane. And reading those stories and meeting those people is definitely fuel in the tank. Another thing you can do with cynicism, though, is you can kind of recast it. And people often confuse skepticism with cynicism. So cynicism is just believing that things can't get better. Skepticism is questioning. And you can, not very easily, but you can more easily convince your cynic to be less cynical, but make them more of a useful skeptic and get them to say, okay, I do want to make the world better, but I'm going to listen to this voice who's going to help me question it. And that's all part of critical thinking and thinking like an engineer to build things that work without killing people. So there's a healthy dose of kicking the tires on things, being skeptical about people's claims, looking at evidence. And I think the route out of cynicism is probably via skepticism and thoughtful skepticism.
How is engineering serendipity a good principle for pragmatic optimism?
Well, it's the root of all creativity. So, you know, we have problems. We need to solve them. You're not going to solve a problem with your existing way of thinking because clearly the problem's still there. So you have to think differently in order to solve problems. The core of solving problems is coming up with a new way of thinking about something. And therefore, you need to give your mind a whole bunch of tools and fuel in order to think differently. And the best way to do that is to smash yourself into as many new ideas and experiences as possible, because each one of them will enrich the way you think. Because even if you do something that you hate, that you don't like, the reasons you hate it and don't like it will still be interesting to you. And Steve Jobs used to say that creative people feel guilty because they don't really think they've done anything special. And what he means by that is they just wander around trying different things, experiencing different things, reading lots of different books, going to different types of theater or seeing different types of movie or mixing with a wide range of people. And because they have this rich sort of soil of ideas floating around, it becomes to them quite obvious at one point to connect two of those ideas together just because they're in their view. Whereas the person who doesn't do that has a much smaller set of ideas, probably not any at all if they're stuck in the same job doing the same thing day in, day out. So it's very hard for them to be creative because they simply don't have enough stuff floating around in their heads. Mm. So, you know, for instance, one of the things that me and my wife do is we often try and take the other one to something we think the other one will hate. Like, you know, just in theatre. You know, so I've often found myself going to things that I thought, I don't really want to go to this, but my wife thinks it'll be good. And finding myself, you know, really surprised by how I enjoyed it. Some of them I hated for sure. But even, as I said, the reasons I didn't like them still informed my thinking. So you're not going to come up with creative new ideas yourself and for yourself if you're not constantly exposing your mind to different ideas from different people and different viewpoints. And sometimes that's difficult because we like to get comfortable in our prejudices and our beliefs. Mm. But actually, we've got to expose ourselves to all sorts of things in order to become more rounded and more useful to both ourselves, our families, and to society.
The cynic in me, you know, is always telling myself that I don't have the brain to absorb so many things. Yeah, so because I've heard this before. I mean, and I've interviewed a few people who say that, you know, it's the curiosity, wanting to learn, wanting to explore things out of what you consider you are an expert on, or what you consider you know. Maybe it's the expectations. I expected to enjoy everything that I explored. But yeah. It's just maybe realizing that understanding why you don't like something is something in itself.
Yeah, indeed. And actually, you know, when we were children, we loved that feeling. We loved the feeling of going and finding something new that we didn't know anything about. It wasn't something we were fearful of. It was like, what's that? I have to go and touch it and grab it and probably try and smash it on the floor or take it home with me. It's interesting that we don't feel so much that way in adulthood. And Pablo Picasso said this great thing. He said, all children are artists. The problem is how to remain one as we get older. And if you sort of face that fear and go, no, I'm just going to do it anyway, there is a lightness to it which you really benefit from. One of the things I learned from working with the successful people that I do is they've learned to feel slightly excited when they're slightly uncomfortable. So when they don't know what they're doing, when they're slightly out of control, when they're in a space where they're not an expert, they have this kind of like buzz about it. It's similar to the buzz of when you go out on a date with somebody, you don't really know them and you're wondering where it's going. That's a really exciting time. You know, if we approach dating the way that many people approach knowledge, the human race would have died out. So, you know, I think of it as dating knowledge. You know, you don't have to get married to it. You don't have to have a family with it, but go out there and date lots of different ideas and have fun with them. You know, why not?
Okay, I love that. Date more ideas.
Yeah.
I'm with Mark Stevenson talking about the principles of pragmatic optimism. We'll look at principle 4 when we return here on Raise Your Game, BFM 89.9.
Build fortunes modestly. BFM 89.9.
Good morning, Raise Your Game. I'm Tasha Fusil, and Mark Stevenson is here with us this morning. He's an entrepreneur. He's also the author of An Optimist Tour of the Future and the founder of the League of Pragmatic Optimists. And he's been with us to talk about the principles of pragmatic optimism. We've looked at a few already. And the next one is, you are what you do, not what you intend to do. And I like that because we do, you know, like to imagine that we could somehow change our jobs or our lives or the world even. But if only the circumstances were different, right? It always becomes a case of if only we could do this or if only we could do that.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I used to do this all the time. And what I found from working with people that inspired me was that all the time I spent making excuses for why I wasn't doing something, they would just use that time and go and do whatever it was that they could.
Yeah.
And strange enough, they ended up doing more things than I did. It's very comfortable to say, I would do it if. But as Gandhi said, you know, probably one of the wisest things said by anybody ever in history, you know, you've got to be the change you want to see in the world. And again, the dividends of doing that, you know, it's not just good for the planet and society. It's good for you. You suddenly feel you can do things. And the more you do it, the more you feel able to. And so all these things are actually quite virtuous in that they're feedback loops. The more you get out there and do things, the more you feel capable of doing things, the more things you do, the more capable you feel, and so on and so forth. But you've got to get out there and try. And that kind of also ties in with the other principle, which is it's okay to fail, mm-hmm. which, you know, making mistakes is okay. But not trying is kind of irresponsible, which is our fifth principle. Nobody learns anything by not making mistakes. The whole process of learning is doing something you don't know how to do. Mm. You know, I've just had a baby boy, and if I approach the way he's learning to walk in the way most of us approach sort of a new idea, I'd be saying to him, oh, you fell over. You're rubbish at that. Stop doing it. We'll get another child who can walk.
Forget you.
We don't do that. You know, learning to walk, you know, we literally, I can't remember, there's some stratospheric figure, but I think it's like, you know, we fall over some like 20,000 times before we learn to walk as human beings. And that's okay. And nobody thinks walking is a bad idea. So why should you be fearful about making mistakes when you're learning something new? And one of the things, you know, I do with a lot of the people I work with is I get them to reward themselves for their mistakes because they start to see them as a learning experience and an expansion rather than something they should punish themselves for.
Well, with the people that you have worked with, do you ever get a deeper understanding of why they have that fear of making a mistake? Is there a pattern that emerges?
Well, I think it's largely down to our school system, to be honest, in that we are examined. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with exams, but the school system is built around things that are easy to test, because it's hard to get statistics and, you know, make judgments about something that you can't measure. And therefore, our education system is based around things you can measure, which is, do you know something or don't you know something? Can you solve this problem or can't you solve this problem? We're not assessed on our ability to ask an important question or our ability to empathize or collaborate. You know, we're assessed on, can you do this thing or not? And because the system's built that way, we become obsessed, you know, as individuals, schools, as societies with our score. How are we doing? Did we get it right or not? And that's the culture we live in. Is it right or is it wrong? And actually, we've learned that lesson, and therefore we're very terrified of getting things wrong. Mm. It's a bit like the difference between sort of classical music and jazz music. You know, in classical, because it's written down, there's a definite way to do it. And the classical music world is very clear. You know, there's only this way to play it, and you play it that way or you're playing it wrong. Whereas in jazz, it's much more like, well, here's some suggestions about how you might play it, but let's have a jam. So I think we should all try and be a bit more like jazz musicians and a little bit less like classical musicians. Not that I have anything against classical musicians or classical music. It's an analogy. I don't want classical music fans standing me up
to be upset. Yeah,
and berating me.
If you think about the top, like, mistakes, this has been discussed a lot as well. Now a lot of people are saying it's okay to make mistakes. But would you say that there's a caveat, or would you say that, you know, there are certain mistakes that you want to try and avoid, or there's a limitation to the mistakes you can make?
Of course, there are caveats. I know I wouldn't sit with a neurosurgeon just before him going into a very, you know, difficult operation and say, you know, try messing up this time, you know, or, you know, go crazy, you know, indulge yourself.
Yeah,
you know,
experiment a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, experiment a little bit. And I wouldn't say that to, you know, an aircraft pilot, you know. Yeah. Of course, there are caveats to this and you have to use your judgment.
Yeah.
But the things that most people, you know, that most of us day to day are fearful of making mistakes actually don't matter that much. Yet we stop ourselves experimenting because we're fearful of it. And that's kind of a recipe for never learning. And if you're not learning, then where's the enjoyment in life?
All right. Okay. So the next one, think like an engineer, not like a politician. Tell me about that. I like the sound of that.
Well, it's all based around me sort of observing people who get things done. And I'm fascinated by the relationship between complexity and belief systems. So what tends to happen, human beings faced with a complex situation, and the world is getting more complex undeniably, as there are more of us and we're more connected, we reach for a way of thinking about that, something that will help us make sense of it all. It's a natural inclination, and for some people that's a religious belief system. For some people it's a political belief system, and for some people it's a business belief system, corporate belief system. These sort of ways of thinking that say this is the way you think about it. And whilst many of those belief systems have lots of merit, they also have a downside, and a very big one, which is as soon as you have got yourself involved with a belief system, it will make other things outside of that belief system literally unthinkable. You can't see them. So if we look at politics, for instance, people on the far left wing of the political spectrum that I've worked with will say that the free market is a terrible idea and it can, you know, it can never be a good way of doing things. And that's clearly not true, because in some cases the free market or markets are very efficient ways of achieving certain things. If you go to the far right of the political spectrum, you know, some of those people will say that any intervention of the state in our behavior or the way society works is terrible, and the free market should decide everything. And then clearly there are cases where that's not true.
Right.
But if you're stuck in a belief system, you literally can't see the other tools in the bag. I like to say that a belief system is a bit like a plumber coming to your house and deciding not to use half of the tools in his or her toolkit because they're the wrong color. Engineers don't do that. You know, engineers don't build bridges from political or religious perspectives, do they? You know, you don't get a bridge that's built on a left-wing principle or a right-wing principle. They're just built based on evidence and engineering. And over time, bridges have got better because they've just been prepared to go, you know what, I'm going to use what's there, everything that's there, to build a better bridge. And I'm not going to ignore half the tools in the bag. So that's what I mean by it, really, is getting yourself past your own prejudices and beliefs to look at the facts. And another good example is what happens in the corporate world. There's this belief system called shareholder value. That is the thing you should be doing, even if your company is actively destroying the environment which your kids are growing up into. It doesn't make sense to think about shareholder value outside of thinking about the environment. But many people do and think that's perfectly acceptable because they have this rather sort of skewed belief system about how the world works.
I suppose if you start to question or start to consider other belief systems, it can really turn your world upside down.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. It's good to have your world turned upside down. But if you adopt the principles that we have, it's okay, because, you know, if you are able to engineer serendipity, look at different ideas simultaneously, it's okay to hold two differing ideas in your head at the same time and compare them. Any person who's, you know, been thinking about whether they want to date person A or person B has had that and had to consider it, you know, or any person who's sat in a restaurant going, well, do I want, you know, the pad thai or the nasi goreng? You know, these are very simple. We can do that. So it's okay to do it with bigger things. In fact, it's really important that we do. And the more diverse your soil, the more diverse ideas you have in your mind, probably the more informed and more useful conclusion you'll come to. I mean, there's a great theory about the wisdom of crowds, that crowds often make better decisions than individuals. And the reason is because those crowds have lots of diverse viewpoints. And those diverse viewpoints have to kind of argue with each other and come to an agreement that they can all kind of buy into. And surprise, surprise, that thing they come up with actually seems to work better for more people. So you should think about the same in, you know, with your mind. The more ideas you have in there, the better it will probably work for you and for everybody else.
Okay, so just to finish off, and I suppose it's a great principle, the most important one possibly, because I guess if your head's filled with too much cynicism, it doesn't, you know, really leave a lot of room for good ideas, for you to absorb good ideas. So yeah, tell me about the last one, police your own cynicism.
Well, it's just being totally aware that you're probably your default reaction, because you're a human being, because we all, you know, had to deal with lions and fire on the African savannah, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago, your default position will probably be to go, that won't work, I don't like that, not going to happen, that person's new idea is rubbish. And to be aware of that and bring it out into the light and kind of go, oh, you know, that was really useful 100,000 years ago on the African savannah. Maybe in modern-day Malaysia, in the office, maybe that's not helping.
Right.
And maybe I need to put that to one side so that we can achieve more. So it's about being constantly on guard against the voice inside your head that will always stop you experimenting. And as I say, these are the very good reasons why we do that. But most of the time, it's not very helpful. And you've got to ask yourself, do you want to live a life governed by fear and comfort and staying where you are? Or do you want to live a life governed by optimism and ambition and trying something new? Mm-hmm. I think in our hearts, most of us would kind of go, you know what? I think the second one sounds a lot more fun.
Mike Stevenson speaking to us about pragmatic optimism, which he defines in the beginning as being an amalgamation of an engineer and Martin Luther King Jr. Now, apart from his book, An Optimist Tour of the Future, Mark also recommends reading How to Change the World by John Paul Flintoff. So do check that out. Thanks for listening. This has been Raise Your Game, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.